Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of December. A Wednesday it is. Our guest this hour, actually we have two guests, all based on the Great Migrations endeavor, a huge endeavor by National Geographic. It includes this beautiful television program, which if you haven't had a chance to see, I'm sure it will be on DVD, and perhaps National Geographic Channel will repeat it sometime. It was a multi-part series looking at great migrations and discovering for the first time what the migration patterns are of certain species on Earth. It's also the focus of the cover story of National Geographic for the month of November. And we'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. We talked about this in November, but we just didn't have enough time to explore it and to see all of the documentaries, and now we have. And I hope that many of you have seen them so you can join our conversation with your informed observations. We have two guests with us this hour. We start the first half hour with David Quammen. David is a science writer whose work has appeared in National Geographic, Harper's, Rolling Stone, and the New York Times Book Review, and he is the author of the cover story in the November issue of National Geographic. His latest book is The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. He began his professional life as a novelist, and he writes mostly about field biology, evolutionary biology, theoretical ecology, and conservation. He used to write a column on natural science for Outside Magazine, and he travels on assignment whenever possible to jungles and to swamps. We'll welcome phone calls for David. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Later in the hour, Professor Orley Chip Taylor will be joining us. He's the director of the Monarch Watch and a professor of entomology at the University of Kansas. He talks about the survival of the monarch butterfly and the preservation of its migratory pattern being crucial to North American ecosystems. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, nice to be with you.
What an absolutely wonderful project National Geographic has done. The documentary series was just exquisite and important. Your article is so good. It was a wonderful idea, wasn't it?
Well, it is, and it's the kind of thing that takes an organization as large as National Geographic to bite off a piece and like this and chew it up well.
Right. How did you decide what animals you were going to concentrate on? Are they the most endangered, their migration patterns, or just the most interesting animals as far as you were concerned?
Well, the assignment to me was to focus in particular on North American migrations.
Mm.
And as you have mentioned, the TV series goes around the world, looks at a lot of different amazing migrations, including some endangered species. But for me, it was the question of what was most interesting, not necessarily most important, not necessarily most endangered, but representative among North American migrations. And as you see in the article, I picked a mammal species, a bird species, and a reptile species to give us a little of that sense of diversity and the idea that this is a process, a behavior that stretches across the different groups of animals.
And it's something that a lot of people think about this all the time, but quite frankly, it's something that I hadn't thought about because I didn't know about the migration patterns, nor did I know much of anything about, say, pronghorns, these magnificent animals. And some of the footage that we see in the documentary just makes you cringe because they can't get to where they need to go, and they've been doing this for so long. Can you talk about the pronghorns?
Right, yeah, well, the pronghorn, people sometimes call it the pronghorn antelope. It's related to an antelope, but not an antelope. It's North America's fastest endemic ungulate. It's been around for thousands and thousands of years, and one of the reasons it's so fast, scientists suspect, is that it was adapted to escape from its main predator during the Pleistocene, which was the Pleistocene American cheetah.
Oh, my goodness.
Extinct. So we've got this creature that can run extraordinarily fast, but it also goes extraordinarily far, some of the populations anyway. There is a population of pronghorn that migrates from east central Montana up through Saskatchewan into Alberta, and there's another population, the one that I highlight in the article, that migrates from Grand Teton National Park down into northern and central Wyoming, the upper Green River Basin. spends its summers in Grand Teton National Park, migrates across the little pass, little divide at the headwaters of the Gros Ventre River, and then comes down into Wyoming in the area south of Pinedale. And as you mentioned, it's heartbreaking, it's frustrating, it's concerning to see the way that these ancient migrational corridors now are being constricted, pinched, interrupted by the things that we humans are doing.
Mm-hmm. So is anybody doing anything about that?
Absolutely they are. The Wildlife Conservation Society has been working on that issue of the Grand Teton pronghorn with cooperation from the National Park Service. The National Park Service is very concerned about it because they want pronghorns to be resident in Grand Teton. The Forest Service, the Bridger-Teton National Forest, has designated this migrational path as the path of the pronghorn and are giving it special attention, trying to preserve the entire corridor and protect those narrow choke points where the corridor could be interrupted by human activity.
The picture in the film that gets you is when one of the pronghorns gets caught in a fence because there are ranchers in this area. What would the plan be, to get rid of the ranches or to make sure that the fences are something that these animals can jump over?
Well, the interesting thing about pronghorns is that if you raise the bottom strand of barbed wire on a barbed wire fence, pronghorn will go under it. And there's a beautiful shot by Joel Sartori in the magazine of a pronghorn.
Yes, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, doing that. So actually, a little bit of cooperation, a little bit of jawboning, a little bit of communications with ranchers. And it has been discovered that this is a problem that can be fairly easily solved, the problem of barbed wire fencing for ranching. You just get that bottom strand up far enough. I think it's something about 18 or 20 inches off the ground is all it takes. And the pronghorn will go under it, and they'll continue on their path. You can see fences like that up in Alberta. I visited some of the sites up there, and you can see a path through the grass and the sage where many, many pronghorn have passed over many, many years. And if the barbed wire is up high enough, the path continues to go right underneath it.
The thing that you realize, particularly with this animal, is how long some of these animals have been making these migrations. It just is incredible, isn't it? It's just amazing. And you write early in the article about this admirable larger purpose that they have, that come hell or high water, they're going to do this, they've got to do this. Why do they do it? What is guiding them?
Right. And that's one of the things I think is not only most important, but most magnificent, most inspiring about these migrating populations, the fact that they are operating with a larger purpose. It's one of the things that I think gives it a special effect on us humans when we watch these animals moving, to know that they are going from point A not to point B, but from point A to point Z, undistractable, having stored energy reserves, so they can perform this long trip with a larger purpose. What's the larger purpose? Well, to get to resources that aren't available to them in one place year-round. Not every population of animals can get what they need 24/7, 365 in one particular place. So they have to travel. They have to travel across the landscape seasonally, or in some cases they might travel vertically. They might travel up and down seasonally or even daily to get to the resources that they need.
There's a picture of a mountain goat. Do you still live in Montana?
I do. I'm talking to you right now from snowy Bozeman.
Oh, I like that image. Do you see these mountain goats who travel vertically? I didn't know they did that.
Oh, they do. Yeah, particularly, I think the photo, it's a magnificent photo. I think the photo comes from Glacier National Park. Mountain goats feed on lichens and things like that. Very, very difficult, rocky, mountainous terrain, and in some cases they have to migrate up and down by day or by season to get to the lichen, the food supplies that allows them to survive.
And tell me, of the animals that you were looking at, the North American migrations, tell me about their preparations. How do you get ready for this kind of journey?
One of the crucial things you do to get ready for a journey like this is store fat. You need fat reserves in order to make these long trips. There are also certain anticipatory behaviors that signal that there is a larger purpose. Animals are doing something that they wouldn't do if they were going to stay put permanently. As I mentioned in the piece, there's a complicated but very useful definition of migration to distinguish it from other forms of mere movement that an evolutionary biologist named Hugh Dingle came up with. And essentially, there's 5 points. First of all, these are prolonged journeys, not short journeys. They tend to be linear, not zigzaggy. They involve what you mentioned, these special behaviors of preparation, such as overfeeding, you know, bulking up for the long journey. They involve special allocations of energy. And finally, the point that we talked about, you mentioned, I think, earlier, they are undistractable once they start these journeys. Once they're going, they won't be turned aside for something of immediate interest, like a meal. They've got to get where they're going. An Arctic tern, for instance, going from Tierra del Fuego to Alaska, that's one of the examples I cite in the piece, will not be distracted by the possibility of a handout of herring in Monterey Bay. It'll just keep going. The local gulls will be delighted with those handouts from birdwatchers on a boat in Monterey Bay, but the Arctic tern is undistractable. It'll just keep going.
Maybe we need to learn something for people who want to lose weight about finding our purpose.
I think one of the reasons it's so inspiring to humans, the larger purpose. Yeah, there's a message in here for us.
Right. Yeah, there is a message, and I've been trying to figure out what exactly is it. Because I was left in awe when I read the article, when I saw this. I keep telling everybody, you've got to see this documentary because it is just awe-inspiring. It really, and some of the photography that, I guess there are special techniques now so you're able to follow some of these animals. Plus, they've been able to track some of these migrations for the first time.
That's right. Well, there are amazing things that are being done now, both with tracking technology and with photographic technology.
Yeah, it's just great. So tell me about this, why you looked at rattlesnake migration in the Great Plains of Western Canada.
Yeah. That had to be in the article because it's just so wacky. I mean, people don't think of rattlesnakes as a migrating species. And in the southern part of the range, they tend not to be migratory because they can get what they need. For instance, a diamondback rattlesnake in Texas or even a prairie rattlesnake down near the southern extent of its range. I think that probably would be, you know, Oklahoma, Arkansas. It has what it wants year-round, pretty much in one place. But if you're a rattlesnake, the farther north you are, the more important it is to have a really good hibernating den for the winter, because otherwise you can't survive there. Otherwise, you're going to freeze to death. So at the northern extent of its range, the prairie rattlesnake seeks really good underground dens that are deep, but that can be gotten to through cracks, rodent burrows, fissures in the earth. And because those are special requirements, there aren't that many such dens. So when you find one, for instance, like the one that the biologist Dennis Jorgensen showed me on the banks of the South Saskatchewan River outside of Medicine Hat, Alberta, when you find a really good den site, you probably will find a place where hundreds of rattlesnakes share the spot during winter, maybe even 1,000 rattlesnakes. So here you've got a nice, cozy underground den, you know, 20 feet down under a slumping bank of a river, and maybe 900 or 1,000 rattlesnakes all cuddled in there cozily through the winter, staying warm together. And then it gets to be late April, early May. They wake up. They come up to the surface. They look around, and they're surrounded by 999 other rattlesnakes. What do they need at that point? Well, each rattlesnake at that point needs to get away from the others. It needs to get to a place where the density of rodents, food, is higher than the density of other rattlesnakes. So they migrate radially. They migrate like a starburst pattern away from one another in all directions. They go out about, I think the average is about 5 miles in the course of the early summer migration, and they make their living out there through the summer months. They feed, they mate, and then when chilly temperatures arrive, they migrate back to the den.
But they've been hit by cars. Human activity has has resulted in their deaths in some ways, right?
That's right. Well, that's one of the things about migration in general, as embodied by these rattlesnakes in particular. Migration across long distances is a dangerous activity. There's likely to be mortality. Even under natural conditions, it was a dangerous, arduous activity that where not every individual would make it. But now that we humans are making use of the landscape, there are more interruptions. There are more threats. And in the case of rattlesnakes migrating in southern Alberta, that means cars and trucks driving on the ranch roads. That means agricultural equipment, tillers and swathers, turning the soil that could cut up a rattlesnake. All sorts of things are disrupting their ancient migratory pathways. And Dennis Jorgensen suspects, he hasn't proved this yet, but he suspects that those factors may be causing actually an evolutionary pressure away from the migratory behavior. Survival of the fittest, after all, means that if most of the migrating rattlesnakes get killed, the ones that tend not to migrate will be the ones that essentially survive and perpetuate that population.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that's true. And I wonder what happens in the DNA or because these are so many of these animals featured are it's just deep inside them. It's the sun and the moon and the season, and they know when it's time to go. It would require a whole change in their makeup for them to stay at home, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. These behaviors are created by evolution over great, great stretches of time. Extinction can happen quickly, but evolution moves slowly. So that's a problem. That's a threat. If the migratory pathways are interrupted, the animals have to somehow adapt. But adaptation doesn't happen quickly.
Right. Well, let's at least have some time to take some phone calls for you. David Quammen is our guest, the first part of the program. He's an award-winning science, nature, and travel writer, and his piece appears in the November issue. It's the cover story of National Geographic, Mysteries of Great Migrations, What Guides Them into the Unknown. And his assignment, as you heard him say, was to concentrate on North American migrations. The documentary on National Geographic Graphic Channel looks at animals all over the world, in the water and on land. So here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join this conversation. We have time to take a few phone calls for David. And I hope there's somebody listening who has seen the National Geographic special or has read the article, too, because it is just, it is so moving what we've discovered. And there's alarming information about how the Earth is changing and animals have had to change their migratory patterns as well. So call us, okay? We just have a few minutes with David, and then we're going to talk about butterflies. We'll welcome your calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second half hour of this hour, for those of you who saw the documentary, Professor Orly Chip Taylor, who's director of the Monarch Watch and professor of entomology at the University of Kansas, will be joining us. David Quammen is here now, and we start our calls with Mary from Lebanon. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I'm just calling because we have a nice, wonderful area that we put in our land preservation for wildlife habitat, and we have watch every spring. We wait for the grosbeaks. It's always an exciting day when they arrive, and we watch for the orioles and hummingbirds, and we're constantly feeding and have a variety of sources for animals to live. And I don't think people realize the importance of preserving grasslands and woodlands. Oh, that's a nice place to build. We don't think about saving anything for wildlife. And I think that's something that people need to wake up about.
Yeah, I think you're right. People don't think about it. Many people don't think about it at all.
Oh, no, right. We need another shopping center. We don't care what we cut down in the process. You know, it's build more, and we don't think about what we're preserving because you can only buy so much. And the rewards that we get daily from watching wildlife, you can't even put a dollar amount on it.
It is priceless. I'm sure it is. David.
Mary, yes, good point. And one of the things that Mary alludes to is the fact that these migrating species, particularly the birds, need stopover points. The The mammals, the reptiles obviously need continuous corridors to migrate. The birds, we think, well, they can just fly. It doesn't matter what's going on the ground. But they have to stop. They have to stop over to sleep at night. They have to stop over in certain places to spend as much as a couple of weeks recharging their batteries, building back up their fat reserves before they travel on. And if those stopover points of habitat are eliminated, then the bird migrations cease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's really an important part of our lives, and you know, watching the different sparrows that come and birds of prey, and it's just, I mean, we really enjoy it, and it's really a special part of our day. So thank you for your work too.
Thank you so much, Mary, for your call. Louise from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Louise.
Hello. I have a quick question. The term adaptation has been used in the discussion here, and I am a former retired middle science school teacher and a school teacher of science in middle school. And one of the concepts that I found to be difficult to explain was the difference between the idea of adaptation that we use socially in our everyday living versus the idea of adaptation that species undergo as they evolve. And I'd like to hear his discussion of
right.
that.
Okay, I'll take a stab at that, Louise. Well, we as humans, we think of adaptation as a change in behavior. You know, something happens and we have to change our habits, so we adapt, and bingo, then we've got a new behavior. But in the evolutionary sense, adaptation is something that's shaped by natural selection in the sense that Darwin used that term in his great theory, which means that those individuals that don't have a particular attribute that's necessary for survival are the ones that die or the ones that fail to successfully leave offspring. The ones that do happen to have it, because of just a tiny random difference in their genome, then those are the ones who survive and who reproduce. And over the long stretches of time, over multiple generations, those changes tend to change the shape, the body type, or the behaviors of an entire population of a species. And that's what we mean by adaptation. Is that what you had in mind?
Yes, that is. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Louise, for your call. And let's go to Dave next from West Salem. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
Dan, I'm calling, I guess, just quickly. You know, I have colleagues out on the Great Plains and who are studying, we look at the different mosquito species, but they're talking about some of these long-term, these small ponds that are so vital for migratory birds and how they're disappearing. And, you know, what that means to migratory path of birds. And, you know, in the context we were looking at, it was like, you know, certain birds in Vermont, for West Nile, and things like that. But, you know, just that whole migratory path through the Great Plains area and some of those birds. And you know, just quickly, you know, when you talk about some of the things like adaptations, you know, for humans and this obvious environmental thing, skin pigment, you know, we think about terms, years, and really it's only about 2,500 years, you know, for those changes to take place. It's really really pretty quick window, but I'm just wondering about the migratory path for those birds in those pools.
Well, again, stopover points, Dave. It's good that you mentioned those. The great central migratory flyway up and down the Midwest of the U.S. Is much affected by human activities, obviously, and so those places where birds can stop over, the small ponds, the riparian areas along rivers. In the article, I write about a very important stopover area on the Platte River in Nebraska, where roughly 500,000 sandhill cranes stop over each spring and each fall on their way from their wintering grounds up to their summering grounds and breeding grounds in Canada, in the Arctic, Alaska, and all the way across to eastern Russia. these shallows of the Platte River are the place where the cranes stop over for 2 or 3 weeks in order to feed on waste corn from the fields nearby that's been missed by the harvester. A lesser sandhill crane weighs about 6 pounds, and during a 2 or 3 week stopover on the Platte River, it might gain as much as another pound and a half, another 25% of its body weight. And that's absolutely necessary to allow those cranes to get to eastern Russia or Alaska. So if you don't have those shallows, just a short stretch on the Platte River, then you don't have a migrating crane population.
And it's one of the wonderful things about National Geographic is that there is a picture of those cranes that's just a knockout picture, and you realize completely that they have to have that area because look at how many of them are there. They need it.
Right. Yeah, when I visited there, as I say in the article, one morning I got up to watch fly out, and I probably had about 60,000 cranes just in the field with my binoculars.
Oh, my. That must have been something. Well, I thank you so much for being with us. Please just join us again after you do your next project.
I'd love to, Kathleen. It's a pleasure, and thank you for your attention to this subject.
Yeah, our great pleasure. David Quammen, science writer. His work has appeared in a number of publications. He does have the cover story on the November issue of National Geographic, Mysteries of Great Migration, What Guides Them into the Unknown. His article and a large part of the documentary on the National Geographic channel looked at monarch butterflies, and we have learned just recently about much more about their migration patterns because we've been able to tag them, and the documentary looks at how very, very lightweight, because you need one, monarch butterflies don't weigh very much, to track them, was developed. And our guest was involved in flying along, looking at where the monarch butterflies were going, and it's this great sense of wonder when it is determined that this tracing mechanism actually works. Professor Chip Taylor, director of the Monarch Watch and a professor of entomology at the University of Kansas, is our guest now for the remainder of the hour. Survival of the species and preservation of its migratory pattern, he says, are crucial to North American ecosystems, and human activity, like the destruction of flowering wild plants that butterflies depend upon for nectar and logging in the Mexican forests in which they spend their winter, is a threat to their existence. We talk with him the remainder of the hour and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And thank you so much, Chip Taylor, for being with us. I can't speak highly enough about the National Geographic special and your sense of wonder when you were following these monarch butterflies you could tag for the first time was just a sight to behold, sir.
Well, we really had a lot of fun with that, Kathleen. It was a pleasure to work with Martin Wachelski from Germany on that project, and to work with the National Geographic crew that filmed it. It was a wonder to me because there were a couple of things that happened there that I was very excited about in addition to recovering this butterfly. To let your listeners know what was going on here, we radio-tagged, that is right, radio-tagged a monarch butterfly.
Wow.
Very first time. And when they first called me up about this, I said, you're going to do what? And they said, yes, we're going to put a radio tag on a monarch butterfly. I said, do you realize how much those weigh? I mean, we're talking about an insect that weighs 0.5 grams. Do you have a radio tag that weighs less than that the butterfly could actually carry? And they said, well, yes, we do. We think that we can make this work. And they reminded me about Martin Wachelski, and I said, well, don't you remember the study that Martin did where he tracked dragonflies that he radio-tagged? And I said, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember that. I'll better look it up. I looked it up, and sure enough, he had successfully tracked dragonflies for up to 100 miles over a period of days using this radio system. And I said, well, maybe we can make this work for monarchs. But it worked beyond my expectations. And we had one really marvelous recovery that, as you said, we followed looked for this butterfly that was radio tagged with an airplane. And when we found it, I'll tell you, we were very,
no,
very
you excited. Sure were. Now, tell me why you would do that. What do you learn from radio tagging?
Well, first of all, this was a proof of concept. I mean, can you take a radio tag and put it on an insect like this, get it to fly normally, and then recover it? I mean, that was, you know, the first mission here was to find out if that would work, and of course it did work. But the other thing that I got very excited about here was that in order to do this, and it's a little bit misrepresented in the video, but in order to do this, I had to raise butterflies. I raised monarch butterflies under greenhouse conditions so they would take on the behavior of butterflies that would be normally moving north in May. And what I wanted to do was create monarchs that would move north-northeast, as monarchs do when they're coming out of Texas. So we get first-generation monarchs that are born in Texas and maybe southern Oklahoma, and they move north-northeast and colonize the rest of the country, just like they're coming up into Wisconsin in mid-May and so on and so forth. And while we were filming this, we did have butterflies moving past us, and they were moving north-northeast. What I wanted to do was create a butterfly that moved north-northeast so that we would minimize the problems that we would have, among other things, of finding them. In other words, if we could look in one direction as opposed to 360 degrees, then we'd have a better chance of recovering them. But I also was curious as to whether I could create a butterfly that would behave that way, because that had never been done before. And sure enough, so all of the butterflies, the six butterflies we tagged, all moved in a northeasterly direction. Now, two of them really moved off the airport, and they moved a great distance. One of them we never recovered. We don't know where that one went. It apparently went beyond the range at which we were searching for an airplane, with the airplane, which mm-hmm. is very impressive, because we searched an area of almost 15 miles radius to the north-northeast of where we had released those butterflies. And when we did get this beep, I'll tell you, you know, this thing is, this radio tag emits a beep every 3 seconds. And so you're flying over this terrain, this beautiful terrain that we have here in eastern Kansas, and you're flying over that terrain and, you know, scanning the area down below and saying, I wonder if it could fly here. I wonder if there could be one there. And all of a sudden, bing, bing, and we just went crazy.
I know you did. It's like you were a little kid. It was
great. Yeah, right, exactly. It's Big Boy. That's the name we'd given to this butterfly. It was Big Boy. And so we got really excited about finding Big Boy. And I'll tell you the story, because it's really kind of silly. We circled around and circled around when we got to finding Big Boy. And we established that it was no longer moving. It was just sitting someplace. And then the question is, where was it sitting? So we GPSed it from the airplane. You know, this is exactly the field that it's sitting in. And we can go back to the airport, and we can get everybody on board, and we can run up there, and we can see if we can find it. So we go back to the airport, we get everybody involved, and get all the camera crews involved, and we race back up there. And sure enough, as we pass along the road, we could still hear that bing, bing. So then we had to find a landowner, right? All right, we found the landowner. And then, can you imagine this? We had to walk up to his door, knock on the door, and say, can we look for our butterfly in your field? I mean, if the cameraman hadn't been there, I don't know if I'd have the courage to do
right.
that. But, you know, you could get shot for being silly like that around here. But anyway, I'm just teasing. But it was kind of an odd sort of thing to have to knock on somebody's door and ask if we could walk in the field. Well, we walked in the field for a better part of 25, 30 minutes before we found a Big Boy. And Big Boy was sitting on a lead plant about 3 feet off the ground, and we all came around this corner and saw him at once. And again, we got really excited, because there he was, and he was still binging away, and he had this antenna sticking out from the below him on the rear end. And so we approached him, took a lot of pictures, and then I went up to him with a net, because we wanted to recover the tag and hold them and remove the tag, because these things cost $100 a piece. And so I foolishly went up to Big Boy, and on camera I said, come to Papa, Big Boy, as I swept him into the net. And they modified that when they did the film. But anyway, it was kind of fun, and it was funny, and we were very, very excited about it. And my thrill was that two things. We recovered a butterfly that went 11.4 miles on perhaps just one flight, and it went in the right direction. It went in the direction that I had, in a sense, programmed it to do. Mm-hmm. So that was really fun. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed working with all those people, and I thought they did a very nice job with that little presentation.
Oh, it was wonderful. Let's talk about the overall importance of the monarch butterfly and the North American Monarch Conservation Plan that you're working on to advocate the implementation of measures to enhance, restore, and to protect monarch habitats. I guess the first question here is why it's important to do that. What is their link?
Well, we've got a marvelous migration here, one of the most fantastic natural phenomena on the planet. I mean, when you've got hundreds of millions of butterflies that go to Mexico to overwinter, you've got a phenomena that is spectacular to see, but it's a wonder. It's a natural wonder at the same time. And we need to protect it. And the equation for protecting it involves protecting the habitats down in Mexico where they overwinter, but also providing habitat for them here in the United States and Canada. And unfortunately, due to development, the use of herbicides, and so on and so forth, we have really carved up the habitat tremendously. And so we have large areas now where there is no habitat. I mean, as you can, all you have to do is fly across this country and look at how agriculture has gobbled up most of the wild habitat out there. But we're going beyond that. We're taking all the margins of our highways and byways and simplifying them with the use of herbicides and excessive mowing and things of this sort, all of which tend to eliminate not only the milkweeds that monarchs need, but the wild plants that many of the pollinators need. So what we're trying to do to compensate for the fact that we're losing 6,000 acres a day is have a program which we call Bring Back the Monarchs. If people go to our website, which is just monarchwatch.org, they can see that we have a program called Bring Back the Monarchs, in which we're advocating milkweed restoration throughout the entire United States on a regional basis, using milkweeds that are appropriate for each state and each location. And we're spearheading a program, and it's part of this monarch plan that you mentioned, and we're spearheading this program to restore milkweeds, either using seeds or using plugs, and trying to get the habitat squared away here so that we can maintain this migration. And we're facing tremendous change over the next 40 years, and we're going to lose a lot of these things unless we really make a concerted effort to put things in place now and keep things knitted together.
It is remarkable to look at, and when you say they are a wonder, it's one of the more remarkable stories out of a number of remarkable stories that are in the National Geographic documentary. Part of it is that it takes three to four generations for this migration to happen?
Yeah, what happens is they overwinter in Mexico, and then you've got a generation that comes up into the southern United States. They, in turn, send offspring up to colonize all of the northern states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota and all the way up into Ontario. And then you get two or three more generations, depending upon where they kind of stop. And then the whole thing starts over again, and most of the butterflies moving south are three or four generations separated from the migration of the previous fall. And that is remarkable because there's no collective memory of where to go or how to do it or nobody to teach anybody how to do it, and somehow they find their way down to Mexico. And, you know, you're talking about an insect that weighs half a gram. I mean, that's just a tiny, tiny amount. And yet somehow within its genetic programming, it has a response to all the environmental changes and all the physiographic features and whatever. We don't know what all the conditions are. They're able to have a system which allows them to get back to these overwintering sites in Mexico. And I'm just stunned by this. I mean, this is just a remarkable biological phenomena.
You're stunned by it, and you study it. I've seen it for the first time, and I'm stunned by it. You continue to be. And have we discovered fairly recently, Professor Taylor, where they go in Mexico? Because the documentary captures thousands and thousands and thousands of butterflies in this very small area in Mexico where they go in the winter. Was that a recent discovery?
Well, it's a discovery that was made in 1975, which is really quite recent. I mean, given the remarkable efforts of biologists to document what's going on around the world that took place throughout the last two centuries, the fact that they missed these overwintering monarchs down in Mexico, is pretty remarkable, and it was quite a bit of detective work for Fred Urquhart of the University of Toronto and his associates to track down these overwintering sites. And I mean, certainly there were a number of educated people that went into those mountains and saw those butterflies, but they never reported them to the biological world.
Oh, my. So let's talk a little bit more before we go to phone calls about milkweed. If we planted in, I live in Milwaukee, if we planted milkweed in our backyards in huge numbers in this city, would we get a lot of monarch butterflies?
Oh, yes. I
mean, we would.
Yes, if you create it, they will come. And in fact, you have a big conservation effort going on in Milwaukee. There's been quite a bit of public conversation about protecting this property that the county apparently owned. I don't know all of the details about it, but you have some local people in Milwaukee that are very concerned about monarch conservation, and they've been trying to protect some property that is potentially going to be used by the university there. They're trying to protect this monarch passageway through there. So they're trying to create habitat in Milwaukee, and they're trying to maintain an area that the monarchs use as they move south each fall through that area.
Hmm. Oh, there's so much to be concerned about, isn't there? Oh, my. Professor Orly Chip Taylor, director of Monarch Watch and professor of entomology at the University of Kansas, featured prominently in the National Geographic Great Migrations documentary series, which has just concluded. It's airing on National Geographic, although it's available on DVD now. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Janice from La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. Thank you and your guests. Thanks for taking the call. I just live on the river, the Mississippi River, and have the big cornfields all behind me. And I am really upset. This is like serious to me that we're losing the monarch butterflies. We're losing no more Baltimore orioles. I can't find them anymore. I mean, the birds, the lightning bugs. It's like where did everything go? And I'm thinking, okay, what is it? Is it the pesticides? Is it the noise of this interstate highway out there too? I mean, all these different chemicals that we've been putting out on these fields. I can't find them anymore, and it's just actually depressing. And I have to say this. I know this sounds stupid, but those little—we used to call them the little teddy bears, that I would see on the bike trail, and I go, "Oh, they've all disappeared. Where'd they go?" So I don't know what's going on, but I think we've pesticided ourselves to death here. So, thank you.
Thank you for the call, Professor Taylor.
Well, I think your caller asks a very good question. What is happening out there? And we're seeing a lot of things change. Lightning bugs do seem to be going down, and nobody seems to know why. There is, if you Google fireflies, you will find that there is quite a bit of concern about what's happening to fireflies. I don't know about Baltimore Orioles, but basically what we're doing with a lot of habitat is that we're simplifying it. And we're simplifying it so that we have huge monocultures of crops. We're simplifying our roadsides by using herbicides on them so that we don't have anything but fescue and brome grass out there in a lot of places. And this eliminates a lot of resources for wildlife, and this is what we're trying to reverse here. We're trying to get people to come up with a new ethic about all of these marginal lands here so that we can really maintain the pollinators, the butterflies, and all of these things that provide services, that provide the fruits, nuts, berries, seeds, and foliage for all of the other things out there, like the ground nesting birds and the small mammals and so on and so forth. I mean, you don't support a lot of wildlife with brome grass or fescue, and we've really got to get away from that and provide some what we call biodiversity, provide some complexity out there, and then a lot of these things will come back.
Mm-hmm. Janice, thank you. Tom in Egg Harbor, hi.
Hi, I saw something this fall, mid to late September, I've never seen before. We had a very mild day, low winds, and all day long we had tons of monarchs just moving around our property in this whole area. And at sundown, they were just kind of everywhere in the sky, and I noticed them gravitating to the tops and edges of the hardwood trees, still leaves on the trees. in the sun, the late evening sun, and just clustering there and resting. And I think one branch close to the house here in one area, I think it must have had about 60 monarchs.
Oh,
there.
What
there
a
are
sight.
About three or four other spots like that all down kind of our sunny driveway. It's in through the woods, but it catches the sun edge, the tops of the sides of the trees there in the evening sun. And I saw other spots down there where you'd see them homing in on. And I'd never seen anything like that before. We've always had monarchs, greater or lesser numbers in this area, but I just never saw anything like that. They were just, it wasn't like there were hordes of them at any given time, but it was nonstop all day long. All those 20, anywhere from 20 to 5 to, you know, 8 monarchs in the air right in our immediate yard. And then as evening came in, they were just homing in from everywhere on that edge, that sunlit edge of the woods in the treetops.
You've made a very good observation, and one that many other people have made as well, and that is at the end of the day, on a sunny day, very often the monarchs will cluster on the sunny side of a tree toward evening. And one of the interesting things about what they do is how high they cluster depends upon, and how tightly they cluster depends upon the temperature at the time the clustering is taking place. So if the temperatures are really low at the time the clusters are forming, they tend to be very, very high in the trees if the temperatures, and they're very tightly clustered, and if the temperatures are very high, then they tend to be very diffuse, and they might be anywhere on the trees from nearly ground level all the way up to the tops of the trees.
Thank you so much, Tom, for the call. Let's talk a little bit more in the few minutes that we have left here about this mind-boggling ability to fly thousands of miles to and from their wintering destinations. What have we learned? What factors influence their migration? Why do they do this? How do they do it?
Yes, these are really good questions, and they're difficult to answer in entirety because we don't know a lot of things. But first of all, let's look at how they fly. What they do is they glide and soar. So they're using powered flight much of the time than we see them, but very often when they're moving south, they're using thermals. They're rising up in thermals like small hawks are, and they use the thermals and to soar, and then they glide out of the top of the thermals. And so sometimes the migration, if the weather conditions are right, provides them with an opportunity to really move very effortlessly to the south-southwest by using the thermals and gliding and so on and so forth. So they're not using powered flight as much as we might think they do. So they arrive in Mexico in remarkably good condition. One of the things that is a mystery is how they set a course, because the monarchs in the different parts of the country all have different headings. So the monarchs that are coming out of Wisconsin are probably going pretty close to due south, but by the time they get here, they're going southwest. And if we look at monarchs as they're going out of Atlanta, they're going almost due west, all of which are appropriate directions to get them to Mexico. But we don't know how they set that direction. That's the real navigation question that's unanswered. So we've got first of all, how they power the flight. They do that very easily. How they set the course, we don't know. And then how they energize all of this, we don't know much about either, but they feed on flowers to get nectar every day, and that gives them the carbohydrates they need to power the flight. So that's an important factor as well. And they're not moving great distances most days. Most days the migration only moves about 25, 30 miles per day. But then if they get the right kind of winds, they will use the winds. And very often they will wait at a certain location until they get favorable winds. So they don't fly into a strong wind. They can't fly into strong southwesterly winds, for example. But if we have a storm that comes out of the northwest, very often they'll pick up on those fronts when they come through, and they'll soar and glide and flutter if they need to on those fronts, and advance at maybe 100, 150 miles a day. So they have a number of different strategies that allow them to move across the country. Now, if they are pushed significantly to the southeast, then they probably have to reset their direction because they get off course that way. So we're not quite sure how they do that, but we've done experiments that show that they do reset their direction if you move them across the country.
Oh, what a world. What a wonderful world. What a world that needs to pay attention to all of this. Well, I'm going to plant milkweed. That's what I got from this interview. And I thank you so much for the important work you're doing and for your wonderful enthusiasm. Thank you, Professor Taylor.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. Nice talking to you all.
Professor Orly Chip Taylor, director of the Monarch Watch and professor of entomology at the University of Kansas. Again, you can go to the National Geographic website to get more information about the Great Migrations, and perhaps they'll rerun that great series that was on National Geographic, but it will be available by DVD in the not-too-distant future. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, where we'll do what we can to make sure we keep getting monarchs. Tomorrow, we did find Frank Kovac from the Frank Kovac Planetarium. He will be with us tomorrow. He built this in his backyard, and we think if you live in that area, you should pay it a visit. I'm really looking forward to talking with him, and we'll also have one of our favorite astronomers with us tomorrow, too, from England. So join us then. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for your calls. Great conversations ahead.